Hello, this is Jesse Liberty, and this is yet another podcast.
Today I have my sometimes co-host, John Galloway, and along with John, I've got John Papa, who is a good friend, a great person, an extraordinary presenter. John Papa, how are you?
I'm doing well, Jesse. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well. And John Galloway, you with us?
I sure am.
Great. Great to have both of you here. Mr. Papa, you were very much part of the inspiration that led me to Pluralsight and your new course on Pluralsight on single-page applications is in the top three, I believe.
Yeah, I've been blessed to see how popular it's been lately. It's been good.
It's been extraordinary. And I watched a good piece of the course, and it was excellent. It's engaging, and it's got great graphics. And how long did you work on that course?
Well, that's one of those. I have two flavors of courses. One's an end-to-end where you build an app like this one. And then I've got some that are more, as I call, MSDN-ish, where you just pick a topic and kind of go through it one at a time. Those ones are easier. The end-to-end ones like this one was more time-consuming because it probably took me about 7 weeks to put together the app and then about 5 weeks to record the course. So, you know, consider it about 3 months.
I would say that that's quite a course for even 3 months' work. How many hours is the course?
It is 5 hours and 10 minutes.
The man's a machine. So shall we talk about single-page applications and what they are and why anyone would care?
Yeah, I think it's a timely topic, and it's amazing how this, while SPA's been around for a while, single-page apps, it really has hit the Microsoft world quite a bit hard in the last year and a half to 2 years. And I think one of the first things that spurred that on was, you know, Silverlight going the direction that it's gone, Flash, the iPad, all these things coming out, and then one of John's cohorts, Steve Sanderson, came out with it wasn't him, but it was Microsoft, and Steve was leading the effort, I believe, on Upshot.js.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I think that really spurred a lot of people's minds. I know it helped me think more about, you know, I can do a lot more in HTML5 and JavaScript now that I'm looking at what some of these things that Upshot could do. And John, you probably know Upshot better than I ever did.
Well, you know, I've seen kind of the history on where it was going. I mean, a lot of that came from the, I'm thinking of code names. But there was like Rhea.js, and there was before that was with now I forget the name of it for Silverlight.
Rhea Service. Yeah, Rhea Services became exactly. Rhea.js, and that became Upshot, and then that became dead.
Yep. So and
that
was
what happened to Rhea Service. You know, I'm no joke. I've been wondering what happened to Rhea Services. So.
It basically became Upshot. And just a quick side note, not to sidetrack John too much, but yes, Upshot's dead, but Rhea Services in the JavaScript world is basically now Breeze.js.
Yeah, I mean, and I talked to Ward on Herding Code about that, and he was saying, you know, that's really kind of the idea that the inspiration and the idea he was working on was to build to finish that vision kind of, you know. And Rhea Services did all that kind of stuff of synchronizing data and handling things client and server and making it seamless to work with data in a way that single page applications or Silverlight at the time doesn't really do easily for you right out of the box.
Yeah, it's amazing to think that all that stuff that some of the biggest reasons I loved Silverlight and I still love Silverlight is all the stuff we could do client side in a nice presentational manner and keep our separation of concerns, but still have rich data. And Breeze really helps bring that back to it, which is great because all that plumbing code that you normally have to write to cache data and share it does quite a bit for you. But you know, one of the things that we started this talking, you know, what is SPA and why is it picking up? I think I had a really interesting presentation about a week ago. I was blessed enough to have a dual session with Scott Hanselman at a conference called Angle Brackets. It's a new conference for web lovers that we've been creating. And Scott asked me to do this modern SPA session with him. And going through this session, we decided that we were going to take it from the angle of, let's not talk about why you need SPA. Instead, Scott started off by showing some stuff he'd done recently on his website to demonstrate his podcast page and how he wrote it all in ASP.NET with model binding, and you know, it worked fine. But then he started showing some problems he had as he wrote this, where he had 8 mega files that were being pictures that were being uploaded on the page every time he went to it. And he slowly started introducing JavaScript to solve these problems. And by the time he was done, he'd written about 20 lines of JavaScript total, I'm guessing. And then it's like, you know, he looked at me, he goes, is this a SPA? And I'm like, yeah, you're getting that beginnings now of having that client-side interactivity. And that was kind of the lead into the whole session. I think it worked really well because it showed everybody that, you know, it's not that you should do SPA because we're saying SPA. It's that you can still keep ASP.NET, whether it's web forms or MVC. And on the client, you can start using little bits of JavaScript and HTML and CSS to really make your app soar.
You know, that's such a key thing. And I love technologies that let you like make a little investment and get a little benefit and make a little more and get more benefit, you know, and that was something, you know, when I was doing more Silverlight, I was always a fan of like you saw some people doing full page Silverlight apps, but I really like the idea of, you know, bring in some Silverlight controls into an HTML page. And I'm only bringing that in as a, you know, the idea of like you're saying there, you can make some investments in single page or HTML5 in general, and then kind of, you know, already, like John, we talked about this previously on another podcast where we were talking about SEO and SPA, you know, and how you decide, well, you know, do I give up search engine optimization in order to get SPA interactivity? And you said, well, you know, you can do both. You can have a shopping cart that's traditional web app and then bring in SPA maybe for the checkout process or for admin or things like that.
Exactly. I mean, you can still use the best of ASP.NET on the back end and still just in the client. You know, your client in ASP.NET never was, I mean, ASP.NET really isn't a client. It's server-generated HTML, which is fine. I mean, it's great. But there's certain things that are just so much better suited to the client. And instead of making a round trip, if you can avoid that in some places, to me, that's where SPA really shines.
Let me back you up a minute, John. The last time that I was doing web programming, I heard virtually the same words about AJAX, that you could continue to use ASP.NET, but by using AJAX, by using some Java on the client and getting the data in the background.
Wait. You can't say Java.
JavaScript.
I flinch every time you say sorry. Java because I think I'm going to get an ask toolbar installer prompt.
Yes.
Okay.
Sorry. No, you're absolutely right. Using JavaScript on the client and doing some of your database in the background and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But the key word there was AJAX, and now it's SPA. So are they very different things, or is one an outgrowth of the other, or do I have this totally confused?
No, I think that you're on the right track with that. I mean, one of the first things that we could do on the client many years ago was AJAX. And AJAX is basically the process of getting asynchronous JavaScript and XML to the client. Well, asynchronous JSON, but we no longer use the XML. So now what we're doing is AJAX is the means to get the data to and from the client and the server. So for example, if you want to do a GET to get your data up onto the client, or you want to post data back to the server, and that data could be JSON, raw data, or it could be HTML. It could be images, could be pages. So the AJAX is still there in the SPA. It's just one piece. What's really happened, Jesse, is that the AJAX has grown up. AJAX is just one piece of what we have, which is why it was so, in a lot of ways, convoluted to build a client-side JavaScript app before, because all we had was how do we get our data to and from. Now we've got other tools like Knockout and Breeze and Require.js and Angular that really help us fill out all the other things we do on the client besides pushing and pulling data.
All right, and let's just say one sentence about each of those that you just named, Knockout and Breeze and so on.
Okay, Knockout simply is data binding. It does data binding very, very well, and that's all it does. Breeze is for rich data. Think of that like RIA services for JavaScript. It allows you to do things like caching of data and writing link-like queries and paging and filtering, stuff like that. What else did I say? Angular? Angular is kind of like, it does what Knockout does. It's got data binding, but it also has application specific features in it. So you can do paging and navigation on the client without hitting the server. And then I mentioned Require.js, which this is not a great comparison, but if you think of it in the .NET world, I think of Require.js as kind of being like a dependency injection tool, which allows you to do that on the client with JavaScript.
And you know, one thing that I would, one of those that you said there was Angular, and I kind of think of Angular almost as a, like, as you're starting to build out an application that uses a lot of JavaScript, you really need some sort of organization for it. You need some sort of framework to build around, because otherwise it just gets insane. And we've all been around huge spaghetti JavaScript that people just, you know, evolved over time, and that's not a good way to go. Angular, I think of as one of those frameworks that kind of says, okay, here we're going to go with this sort of MVC approach, and, you know, here's how we're doing routing and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, and I'm having a lot of discussions lately on frameworks. And to be honest with you, the two that I choose, and I'll be very opinionated on this, I like AngularJS a lot, and I like Durandal a lot. And just quickly, what both of those do is they both give you that framework that John's alluding to get you started and keep you organized. But they both have dependency injection. They both have modularity. They both have that client-side page navigation. And which, when you're really comparing them, a lot of people get confused. They think Angular does everything for you. It doesn't do everything. It gets you started with a good chunk of what you need, but you can still pull in other libraries as you need to do other features like pop-up toast, for example. The comparison to Angular would be Durandal plus Knockout. Durandal gives you the framework to get started, and it gives you that application lifecycle of, you know, routing from page to page and when does your view model load and go away. And then Knockout adds the data binding. So I always like to liken Angular to the equivalent of basically Durandal Knockout put together.
And you haven't mentioned jQuery in this entire...
No, and that's a great point. I mean, jQuery was the first, not the first, but was the biggest of the first JavaScript libraries that really took everybody by storm. And it's used almost ubiquitously these days, if I pronounce that word correctly. But the big thing with jQuery is jQuery does what? It does AJAX calls for you. It helps you with HTTPS and HTTP. It also does DOM manipulation, which is expensive and in some cases difficult in a cross-browser way. And it does other things like helping you apply CSS. It'll help you do like for each loops. And there's a bunch of other little things that it does for you. But the problem is jQuery can become very messy in your code if you don't use it properly. So one of the things that I like to do is not use jQuery and instead use these other libraries, because in a lot of ways, jQuery has become a silver bullet for everything. And I'm trying to avoid that in a lot of my development these days.
So actually, those other libraries are a substitute for jQuery, and you actually are at this point are coding without jQuery.
I still do use jQuery for some things, but like for AJAX calls, I don't use it unless I have to. I don't use it for DOM manipulation anymore. Mostly, I only use it for the few things I need. Like if I need a promise, because they do promises for asynchronous calls, I'll use it. But yes, for the most part, I avoid using jQuery unless I need it. And it's not because it's bad, but it's because I already have other things that I think are better suited for it in a lot of cases.
And it's also 2012.
Well, you know, it's funny, but kind of apropos of that is I've seen some posts recently where people are saying why they're not using jQuery as much anymore or at all. And one thing is that a lot of the cross-browser stuff that it brought in is now, I mean, browsers really do follow standards quite a bit better. So, for instance, you can use like Query Selector All to do that, you know, selection, DOM selection, which was just insane before, you know, to do that cross-browser.
Yeah. Oh, it was insane. So, back when jQuery came out, what, 5-6 years ago? Seems like 100 years ago, but, you know, doing cross-browser DOM manipulation was painful. I mean, it was just, you didn't want to do it. That's why a lot of us went over to the XAML world. So jQuery solved that. But today, like, for example, if I want to do promises, I'll just use a library called Q. Q simply does promises, and that's all it does. If I want to go out and do some kind of DOM manipulation, instead of using jQuery to pull data in and out of objects and put them onto HTML elements, instead I'll use Knockout or Angular.
Okay, John, I have to ask you a question, which is that you were the Silverlight show guy, and you were immersed in Silverlight, immersed in the XAML world, and now you are writing predominantly about web and JavaScript and all of these libraries. How big a learning curve was that? How long did it take you to make that transition?
That's a good question. There was a time when I was towards the end of Microsoft where I was getting into Windows 8, and simultaneously I was dabbling in a lot of JavaScript. And I'd had experience in ASP.NET heavily before, just like, you know, John's Mr. ASP.NET himself, John Galloway, that is. And, you know, going down the JavaScript road was a little painful at first, but what really lit the light bulb for me was not trying to figure out what all these libraries are and how they all work and all these cool little names like Knockout and Angular. But instead, I said, you know, I've got a lot of experience in ASP.NET and Silverlight and WPF. All these separation patterns that I've been doing for the last 15 years, can't I use those in JavaScript? And once I realized I could do that, that was a light bulb for me to say, if I do that, the mess that I always thought was JavaScript really became a lot cleaner, whether you're using Angular, Knockout, or whatever, or none of them. So basically, the whole concept of encapsulation and, you know, solid principles and just separation of concerns is what did the light bulb for me. And it took me a good, I'd say, 3 or 4 months of just working hard on that kind of stuff to figure out how do I want to write my JavaScript. And then it was basically just, you know, keeping up with all the Joneses on what are the latest libraries. And quite honestly, I use things like Twitter just to keep up with that stuff.
You know, John, a side thing, but I've been thinking recently, it's almost worth, I don't know how to do it, but it seems like there's some sort of knowledge base or wiki or flow chart or something for saying like, okay, so what do you want to do? Well, I want to, you know, maybe handle URLs or URL history, or, you know, I want to use an MVC framework and kind of guide you through, do you like this or this, you know, because it's almost a full-time job keeping on top of the different libraries.
It is. It's hard. And I've often thought about coming up with some kind of a website to say, well, okay, you're looking for, we'll use your example, you know, client-side page routing and URLs and history. What are my options and what do people think of them? You know, how stable are these? How good are these things? And, you know, because how do you discover things like SAMe.js if you don't know about them? Because that's what does that. You stumble across them and you hope you ask somebody who knows. That's the difficulty right now. And I think there's a huge opportunity for discoverability of those things from a company with some deep pockets that some people might be working for.
Okay, on that note, you have had tremendous success on Pluralsight with various training courses for various technologies. But I understand that you're now looking at a real departure and doing a course on public speaking. Are we allowed to discuss that, John? Is that NDA?
Yeah, everybody who's listening has to sign an NDA now, but yeah, absolutely. I'm working on I think it's called The Art of Public Speaking and Effective Presentations. I like my big long titles, I guess. But it should be fun. I mean, Jesse, you know, we've talked a lot about speaking skills over the years, and we're both getting up there in age, at least I know I am, and one of the things I've struggled with is I know a lot about speaking and presentations, but I don't always know how to explain it to people and how to do it the right way. So I've taken the time to kind of put all that down in notes, said, you know, I think this would be a good thing to get out there because, you know, when I started public speaking, I was just scared as heck of doing it. I always wanted to. But I mean, my first public speaking experience, which I actually described in the first module of my course, was about as horrific as you could possibly get. And I mean, it's amazing that I still do it today, but everything that could have gone wrong went wrong. And I stuck with it. And there's little tips along the way that I've learned, and I'm sure you have as well, that just really keep you going with it.
You need an appendix at the end of this course where we each get to tell our worst horror story of standing up in front of a room full of people and just bombing.
It's actually funny you say that because I pinged all the Pluralsight authors and asked them to tell me their worst story. And at the end of the course, I'm going to go through like the top 10 of those and let, you know, share them with people with these authors' permissions to say, this is what these people went through. You know, and if you're talking about really popular speakers, guys like Scott Allen and Dan Wallin, and, you know, some of the things that they've gone through, it's, you know, we can all envision ourselves and empathize, but it's kind of humbling when you think that, geez, okay, you know, these guys have gone through to have done 1,000 presentations. It's okay if it happens to me too.
So what are some of the topics in this course?
So the outline is, first I talk about the message. And that's the key thing I think a lot of people skip when they do a presentation is the first two modules. How do you create your message that you're trying to get across to your audience? I mean, what's the main point? And the whole thing's about you can't have 10 most important things. You've got to have one. And how do you find what that one thing is? And I go through some exercises to get there and then show you what you can do with that. And then once you get that message, the second module is all about creating your story arc. How are you going to unravel this message and relate to the audience and inspire them to do something? Because that's the whole reason we speak. We don't speak just so I can read off all the features that Knockout or jQuery has. We're speaking because we want to inspire you to learn more about this and do something about it. And those are the two important chapters in my mind. After that, then I go through things like, how do you do slides? And there's some tips. What do you do with those? How do you do demos? My favorite module is the one I titled A Series of Unfortunate Events. Which is all about all the things that we do to make sure that nothing goes wrong on stage, because we've all had 100 million things go wrong. So what can you do to prepare for those kind of crazy things? Like Jesse usually has the bag of dongles with him, you know, yes. The 500 dongles for his laptop.
500 dongles, two laptops, and a complete backup on thumb drive.
It's amazing. Thumb drive. We're like Boy Scouts. We have to be prepared, you know?
You know, I think some of it, I mean, you always have, when you've got those things, you don't need them. And when you don't have them, you need them.
Yes.
So it keeps the bad things away. But also I find that I do those sorts of things to make sure that I'm not worrying about that. You know, it's more about like, if I can remove that and I know that I've got that thing covered, then it's not nagging me in the back of my mind, my whole talk, or as I'm leading up to the talk, worrying about what might go wrong.
And what's a shame is that most people skip creating your message, putting your story together, and they skip that preparation part to avoid that. And all they do is they jump right to creating slides and demos, and then they go talk. And that's usually a problem, because that's where you get those either dry sessions or you get, you know, when something goes wrong, how do you recover? For example, what happens if the power goes out on the projector or the bulb dies? Sometimes that happens. It happened to me twice. And both times I had no visuals, and I had to stand there for an hour and talk my presentation through with no visuals whatsoever.
Yes, I had a connection problem, and I couldn't plug my laptop into the projector. And somebody went out to buy a connector for me. And so I continued doing my presentation. And then about halfway through, I got the connector and went back to the slides. And a fellow came up to me afterward and said, you know, I really liked it better when you didn't have the slides. Let that be a lesson to you.
You know, and there's all this keys about, you know, knowing your material and so on and so forth. But, you know, some of the best presentations I've ever seen are there's actually a guy at Microsoft once. I did dry runs for, you know, Mix and PDC, and I had to give feedback. And one of the best presentations I ever saw was a guy came in, and he was brilliant. And he had something along the lines of 60 tips on whatever the topic was. And we listened to the whole thing. At the end of it, I said, I didn't write anything down in your presentation. It was all great. So my biggest problem is right now, I think I can remember 5 of those tips. Mm-hmm. And that's it. And I said, I don't really know what the point of the presentation was either. Mm-hmm. I said, you know, I think the biggest problem you have is there's really no point. I walked out of here going, what is the message you're trying to get across? Are you just trying to tell me everything that this thing does? I said, instead, I would rather see you take the top 5 or 10 things that are most important, all related to one area, like performance or stability or making something cool, whatever, graphics, and actually make a presentation about that. And his big feedback was, and I hear this a lot, and you guys probably do too, is, well, I want everybody to have all the tips, so I want to put them all on the deck. And I said, you know what you do is you just do your deck for your 10 most important ones and have a theme and a message and a story for it. But then hide the other 50 tips, the slides in the deck. Just right-click and hide them. And then when you actually distribute that deck, you can give them everything. But you don't want to, if you tell them 60 things, everybody's going to walk out of there and be confused. And he actually took this advice. I don't know why he ever listened to me, but he did. And I thought the new version of it was like a completely different presentation. And it was amazing to me.
That's such a huge thing, is that, you know, like, think about the people watching the presentation and think about them during the presentation and afterwards. And that's, I mean, I've read some books on presentation and definitely worked hard at trying to learn. And that's so key, John, that you point that out, is that, you know, instead of just kind of like diving in with, well, okay, I'm speaking on this topic, so here's my outline and here's my slides, and, you know, maybe I need a cat in here somewhere, and that, like, you know, instead, like, think about, well, okay, by this point, you know, like, what do I want to convey? And maybe it's just, I want people to enjoy this, or maybe it's, you know, hopefully, and that is appropriate for some things, right? And yes. Then others are, you know, well, I really want people to come away with these 3 things, you know, maybe what are the important things of getting started, walk through an app, and where to find out more, you know, and then I can, you can throw in more stuff, but that's, you know, if things are really serving those points, then you've succeeded, you know, and you can judge, like, does my topic work? Does my talk work?
But it's so easy to forget even the fundamentals. I mean, we all know about death by bullet point, and yet I find myself creating slides with bullet points. And, you know, I've had real success with the Zen presentation approach to slides, and yet it's so easy to slip back to the more traditional, really boring kind of slides with a little bit of animation, and to find yourself droning on, and then you do this and then you do that, and keeping yourself up and fresh and ready and prepared and with great slides and a killer presentation is I would argue is tremendously difficult. I mean, I'm sure there are people who find it natural, but I find it to be very, very hard work.
It's a lot of work to prepare for that. You're right. And for me, it's, you know, there's always a discussion of how many slides or how many bullets, or do I use bullets or pictures? Or for me, it's more about not that, but keep the visuals changing. Mm-hmm. You could have one slide with 5 animations on it, 5, let's say, bullets or blocks coming up. Or you could have 5 slides, each with 1 block. It doesn't matter, as long as those things are on the screen for just long enough for them to get the point and to listen to your point and move on to the next topic.
Please, God, don't read the slides to me.
Oh, my gosh, that drives me nuts, especially when people read the title of the slides and bullet by bullet. But, you know, the pictures are nice. As you say, I like pictures too. And I know Jesse's a big fan of that from the Presentation Zen book. But even with pictures, there's a great saying about, you know, don't get too cute.
Yes.
You can't just have a picture of a cat, like John mentioned, if there's really no point to it.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
You know, and that's something
I'm trying to fluff them up at the beginning of the crowd. If you're trying to open up the beginning, like Hanselman's great at that. He'll just put on some wacky video for the first minute before the presentation just to get people thinking.
Yeah. And that, you know, that's something where like how many pictures I use or whatever, or if I sometimes use bullet points, it comes back to, well, what am I trying to convey? And sometimes bullet points, if there's a list of things, it's kind of like people say, you know, an HTML table is actually good if you have tabular data, you know, and sometimes if I've got a list, well, a bullet point, you know, there's a reason why they're kind of standard is it's good at that, but it's just that people abuse that and use it for everything and a lot of things. So, I mean, I went way down the pictures for everything and I think people rate those sessions highly and they're very entertaining, but they don't always. Like I started noticing, do I walk out of those? I walk out happy, but did I actually learn much? You know.
Okay, but see, now I think that's a key point, which is that people walk in saying, what I want is to learn something. But what they rate highly is, have I been entertained? And when you're spending the kind of money you're spending on a conference, there is a deep ambivalence between those two things. Clearly the ideal is to learn something and be entertained. But the truth is, it's a long day with a lot of sessions, and the person who makes the audience laugh and enjoy themselves and even just get a little bit out of it is going to do a whole lot better than the person who provides an overwhelming amount of information, but it's dry as dirt.
Mm. And to me, a lot of the key is being different, breaking the pattern. Now, you think about it, in everything we do in life, there's certain things that we just zone out on. For example, one of my habits is when I code or I do Pluralsight courses, I put on the TV in the background on a TV show that I've already seen, some kind of a movie that I've watched over and over again. Why? Because I just need background noise, and sometimes music doesn't do it for me. And if I've seen the show, I'm not going to focus on it. And if you think about that, if you do a presentation and you do it the old standard standby technique, people aren't really listening to you because you're in that pattern zone, and our brains are tuned in when we hear a pattern to not pay attention. It's when you're different and you do something crazy. You do something a little unexpected and surprise them. That's when you grab their attention and you get them going. Like Hanselman's videos at the beginning of his sessions, he's not showing those videos because he wants to be cute. Well, maybe he does, but you know, he's showing those to make you smile, laugh, and get out of your technical mind for a minute and get into that more emotional, caring mind. And then he goes into his presentation, and the whole thing is go back and forth. So when I present, I try to do, here's my technical topic, here's a funny anecdote that ties it together, and here's something crazy about it. And I try to go back and forth between that because that gets them thinking technically, but it also brings them back to, all right, the only way to think about this is not the logistical Vulcan mind. It's, here's another way of looking at it that relates to real life. And the more you can break out of patterns of people, I find the more interest you get. And that's the way you can get that balance of entertaining and educating. But it's really, really hard to do.